Good morning, men. Welcome to another edition of the Morningstar Men's Fellowship podcast. Today we're going to look at another in Pat Morley's chapters from the book, How God Makes Men. This one dealing with Solomon. Morley addresses, right there in the introduction to the chapter, two key components of a life well lived. Success and happiness. What are they? How do we find them? Why are they seemingly so elusive? And so this morning in our discussion, we evaluate where men look for success, what they conceive of in their own minds as success, and where do we all acquire our ideas of success? And as I encouraged our own men, I'll encourage all of you listening along now. It's not enough to just listen. It's not enough to think good thoughts. It's not even enough to nod your head in agreement with powerful ideas. The only value to a good idea, the only value to truth, is if you'll take the time to use it as a mirror and look into your own life and see where you find good in your life, where you find things that are truth, are noble, and worthy of building on, and where you find things in your own life that are perhaps unworthy of being called a foundation for successful living. I think it's true for almost every one of us that we are in part building our lives on lies that we have absorbed, lies of culture, perhaps lies of family, lies of the deceit that surrounds us about what it is that will make us content, what it is that will bring us success in life. So I invite you to do the same thing that I invited our men, and that is to do a careful and thorough inventory of your own life. Ask yourself the question, from whom, from what do I gather my ideas of what it means to be successful? And once we're done with that, guys, I encourage you to listen through for the remainder of the podcast, because there's some good insights offered as to what it takes to truly find happiness in life, what it takes to build a life that we can look back on with satisfaction and say, I have lived life successfully. Listen along, men. And we'll catch up with you again next week. All right, gentlemen. I guess it's sufficiently past 7:30 that we probably ought to get started. So our topic for the morning, success and happiness, that's it in a nutshell. What does it take for a man to find what we'll call meaningful success? And in what, if any way, are success and happiness connected? I don't know how many of you read the chapter. Hopefully that'll set a bit of background, but we're really going to go pretty far afield from the chapter, actually. Before we get into this, because this is going to sound like such familiar material, and because most of you have covered a lot of these basic ideas time and time again in your lives, we arrive at the point where we think we have things figured out. This is actually our first big point for the morning. And what I hope I'm doing is setting Scott up for next week, because you're going to see this principle lived out when you look at the life of David next week. And here's the idea. That a man can acquire a little bit of wisdom. And that little bit of wisdom that he becomes very comfortable and familiar with starts to inoculate him so that he's not receptive to more wisdom. So what is an inoculation? When you hear that word, what comes to mind? Okay, for what reason? Anybody?
Okay.
There you go. An inoculation's purpose is that if I give you a little of something, it builds up within you a resistance to more of it. What if that's possible with wisdom? What if it's possible that we come to the point in our lives where we think we understand things and we never reconsider them? What if it comes to the point that when I was young and I was foolish and I didn't have any wisdom, I lived in a certain way, and the consequences of that way of living start to show me that I don't want to reap those consequences anymore. It's not maybe that I'm eager for wisdom, I'm simply eager to avoid the consequences of the way I've been living, and so I acquire wisdom for what reason? More wisdom, better life choices, better life choices, better consequences. Think about some of the people that you know. Matter of fact, think of some of the young guys that you work with. How many of you here know a man, or more than one man, who's paying child support right now to someone who he's only a part-time dad to? How many of you know multiple men that are in that condition? Anybody of you know men who are in that condition and paying child support to multiple women? See, and the hands keep going up. How many of those men were reasonably young when they made those choices? And over a period of time, we hope that the man acquires a little bit of wisdom. Now, he can either acquire real wisdom, which is there are long-term consequences not only for myself but to other people, or he can acquire very selfish wisdom that would look like what? I'm just going to be more careful, right? I'm not going to really learn anything from my lesson. I'm just going to be more careful. And then comes a season. And this is where what I'm talking about will be directly applicable to David next week. Then there comes a season where we start to master a collection of wisdom that we build up in our lives. And things go well. Let me ask you another question. When do you think a man is most susceptible to an affair? Is it when he's 2 years into his marriage? 3 years into his marriage? Or is it maybe when he's 10 or 15 or 18 or 20 years into his marriage? And what changes? Why is a guy who's only married a couple of years and seemingly would have less life wisdom less likely to have an affair than a guy who's 18 or 20 years into a marriage and should have probably have more life wisdom? Do you understand the question?
Love is weak. Love is weak.
Okay. Perhaps there's another explanation. And this is what I want us to apply to this morning. It is possible for a guy to acquire wisdom as it relates to one season in his life. But as he enters another season in his life, he doesn't revisit the wisdom he has and say, how do I need to account for this understanding that I have in light of my new circumstances? How do I need to revisit this wisdom in light of the new temptations I may experience, the new opportunities that might be before me? Is my wisdom, here might be a different way of saying it, is my wisdom up to date? And that's why I said this morning, when we hear this material about success and happiness, every one of you has heard this in one form or another. Every one of us. And yet there isn't a man among us who doesn't need to carefully reconsider this in light of the season of life we're living in now. Because I think if the scriptures and the lives of the men that we're going to look at this morning teach us anything, it's this. You're never too old to screw up. So it's not like you have to be young and dumb. As a matter of fact, Solomon even goes so far as to say you can be old and very dumb. And I don't think we want to arrive there. All right. Let me show you a couple of verses that are going to sort of back this up. We'll go over to Ecclesiastes. That's going to be the operating book for the morning. You can turn to the first chapter.
Are there more notes going around the back of your notes?
Scott, did you make more copies?
There's two pages?
Yeah. There's a single-sided page and there's a double-sided page. I had hoped. Okay. The guys who were given the original ones have only gotten the first copy. That's the way I wanted it to work out. Then the double-sided copy would come later. And the idea was I didn't want everybody reading ahead because they were bored with me and starting to see what they needed. That's okay. Let me read a couple of texts here. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And here we get an inkling as to the detachment and the sort of groping and struggling with life that this man is acquiring. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, it is all vanity and a striving after the wind. And then he arrives at this first conclusion. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. In other words, I've come to see that it appears right now that God has given man some, well, he'll call it meaningless and vain and unhappy tasks in life. And he says, I'd like to undo that. But what is crooked doesn't seem to be able to be made straight. I'd like to do something different. I'd like to fix this problem that I see in myself and I see all around me, but it doesn't seem that there's a fix. So I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over me in Jerusalem. Now, that's an interesting statement. Some people actually think that it may not have been Solomon who wrote this, and this text is one of the ones that they cite. Now, if you know anything about Jewish history, when Solomon says that he is greater in wisdom than all the kings of Israel that have come before him, what's he saying? How many kings in Israel came before him? Maybe two if you count Saul. Right? That's a pretty pompous statement. Maybe he's actually referring to all the Jebusite kings that came. If you know, again, a little bit about history, you know that David takes this city that becomes Jerusalem. It is an established city when he conquers it. So maybe he's referring to them. But another theory is that this book is a compilation of wisdom and that there are other kings and that perhaps Solomon or whoever, some later writer, is just using this person as a mouthpiece. And listen to what he says. And I have applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And even this is a striving after the wind. So he would say it like this if he were here today. He said, I have applied myself to see what wisdom's path is and where it takes a man. And conversely, I've studied other people and I've seen where the path of the fool takes him. And have tried to discern a meaningful difference. And keep in mind, this is Solomon, the guy who wrote a lot of the Proverbs, or at least set them down, the ones he heard. And if you look at the Proverbs, you see again and again, what? The way of the wise person is this, the way of the fool is that. And he makes these clear contrasts, and it seems as if he would encourage everybody to be wise, right? And what's he saying here? The entire book is haunted with this message that in the end, make good choices, in the end you end up dead. Make bad choices, in the end you end up dead. This is a man who is caught in the bitterness of his own discoveries. Then he goes on to offer this clever observation. Better to be a poor and a wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. Let's read that again. Better to be a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. Chapter 4 that comes from, and it's verse 13. Remember what we said, that it is possible to be inoculated to further wisdom by the little bit of wisdom that you already have. And if this is Solomon writing, this is probably a very autobiographical statement. This is Solomon describing himself. I remember when it was good to be young and seeking wisdom and gaining an understanding. And now, momentarily at least, he's able to look inside his own life and see, but this is the man I've become. An old man. A man who distanced himself from wisdom. Didn't listen to the voices around him. The very counsel that I gave to other people, I ignored in my own life, and it has taken me to this sad and sorry place in my life. That's not what we want for ourselves. So all that was simply lead in to say, no matter what season of life you are in this morning, I want you to receive this as if it were the first time that you had heard it, and I want you to look inside your own life for what you can learn about your season in life right now. All right, we're going to do a couple of group exercises real quick. If you have the second page, don't look at it, please. If you have a pen or a pencil, I'd like you to be able to take down some notes of your own. The first thing I'd like you to do is very quickly, I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to a minute. I'd like you to define success as you understand it. And let me be clear about this. I don't want your environment to influence you. Just because you're in church, don't you dare write the churchy answer. You don't learn anything by being dishonest with yourself. I want you to write down a picture of success for you. Who will you be? Where will you be? With whom you will be? Will you be? What will you be doing? Go ahead. Does anybody need a pen? That begs the question, does anybody know where any pens can be found? I have one. There's two more. Oh, there's a bag of pens, Scott. Look at that. Does anybody have a pocket knife or something to open the bag of pens? What? Yes, I am, aren't I? That's in my picture of success, to be less needy. We're working on pens. Who else needs a pen? Anybody need more time? Okay. Come back to this again. I'm just setting you up with the basics to do the groundwork in your own life. What you're going to get out of this is in part going to be determined by what you do with it after you leave here. Let's come up with some working words that you would put on a board to describe success. No idea if there's two or one L's in diligent. Anybody?
Probably needs pen.
Okay. Peace? Want to explain that?
I really
that I'm being at peace with who God has made me to be.
Okay. Ooh. Sure you weren't reading the second page, right? Anything else?
Satisfaction.
Okay.
Money.
More on that.
Positive occupation.
Something that you maybe that you enjoy, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll call that meaningful work. Did we exhaust it? Anybody else? It's good because I don't have much more room to write there. Toys? Well, there's an honest man. It's good that somebody says what everybody else was thinking but wouldn't say. Okay. What about happiness then? And if you think of something later, or we want to erase something and move it to a different place, that's fine. What about happiness? Why? Children? You're a young father, aren't you? There is an in-between phase, brother. You just haven't gotten there yet. Family? Yeah, we're just going to substitute the word family because that might catch more stuff. Let's just let that represent immediate family. I think if the broader we make that circle, the less likely that that's going to be true. Just saying, that's all. What else? Contentment. Can we just say good health? Would that work? Good health? Keep going.
An emotional high.
See, now we have somebody who's a deep thinker. So we have the shallow guy with toys, right? And we have the deep thinker who says it's an emotional high. Huh?
I can hear you calling me shallow up there.
Okay. I'm just going to word that simplicity, which is not simplistic, but... Well, what if I could spell it? Don't laugh at me. Peace of mind. Okay? If we're satisfied with that, we'll move on to joy. And now remember, you've put all these operating words up here. So we're going to have to, if there is a distinction between happiness and joy, we're going to have to understand how they are different or how they're alike.
Joy is lasting, but doesn't come from things. I should not have things and still have joy.
Okay, so it is enduring, you're saying? But you captured another idea there. The first was enduring. The second was...
It's not dependent on one.
There you go. Not dependent on outside circumstances, we'll say. Huh? What else?
Consistent.
Ooh, so it's... That's a good word.
Being whole in all circumstances.
Being
made whole in all circumstances.
Whole. That's a good word. We good? Okay, one final reflective thought. I don't know if you captured any of these words. Remember your definition of success? What is found in your definition that's up here? What's different? And I'm not saying that any of these, remember, these are your contributions at your stage of understanding right now. I just want us to put all of our thoughts up here so we can see them. Are you happy right now according to these terms? I'm going to erase this in a few minutes maybe, but we'll leave that up there. And then the idea of joy. So, take a moment, study that. Where are you in relationship to these? I don't know. Do I need to move this for anybody? Can everybody see this? All right. Now we'll pass the second page around. Couple of big ideas now. I'm sure you're not unfamiliar with them, but maybe you'll see something new in them today. So I want to focus first on this idea of happiness. What does it take to have happiness? And maybe we'll put a working definition up, which you find on the back page of your double-sided copy, or on the third page if you had individual copies. What are the distinguishing qualities that separate joy from happiness? We said some of them here.
Non-material things.
Okay. It can be non-material things. What else?
Happiness is a reaction to something outside.
There you go. So happiness is my response to the circumstances I find myself in. Joy? It's tough. It's tough to do it well. I mean, it's easy to borrow somebody else's definition. What do you think?
Comes from a security that's inside, you know, not to be too churchy, but God gave me an anchor that I
Okay.
I get surprised when I'm joyful in bad circumstances.
All right, so if we said that there were conditions present that would promote happiness, does everybody agree with that? There are probably certain conditions which would favor being happy. Are there conditions which favor joy? Okay, that's a good distinction. This is as much for your own personal understanding. Sometimes, how many of you spend a lot of time honestly thinking about this in your everyday life? And that's part of why we're doing this. We're doing it because, and we'll actually bring this right back on track. Show of hands, how many of you would like to spend the rest of your life being unsuccessful? In other words, living in the absence of success. Okay? So we're all takers on the concept of success, right? Who has defined for you what success means? And don't be too quick to answer that. You know what? Everybody, make a visual imprint of this, burn it into your... This is where it's going to start to get personal. Very personal. Maybe more personal than you've ever considered before. What has crafted your current definition of success? So the first one that I heard was society. Okay, church was the next. Did I overlook anybody before that? Church?
Friends and peers.
I could say that, does that mean that your friends are not people and people are not friends? I'm joking. I understand.
The president of the company, or the CEO, or somebody.
What else?
Bible.
Okay, stop a minute before you make any other contributions. Take a look at that list. Wish we could get that back further so you could all see better. Well, yeah, that's one observation. What else? Is there anything that's missing from this list that has had an influence on how you define success? Just stand back and look at that for a minute.
Well, we've got the Bible in there in church. We've got some God in there.
Anything else?
Similar to society, but your actual environment.
Okay. Yeah, we could almost lump that in with society. Okay. It's interesting how slow we were to get down to this. Now, why is that?
Because the one at the top should be the devil.
The devil? Okay, I'll put it up there. I'm not necessarily agreeing just because I write things. I am right now your unpaid scribe.
I can go back to what you were saying. How much time do you think about this stuff? If you're not consciously thinking about it, somebody else is going to mold your thinking or something.
Yeah, and let's come back to what he said right now. The process of thinking for yourself about what defines your success is the only thing that's going to put a firewall between you and the outside world. Because if you don't understand what success should be like, and if you don't resist other people's definitions of success for you, you're very naturally, easily going to be molded into a definition that comes from outside. And since we've already acknowledged that most of us don't spend a lot of time thinking about that, what have we also all acknowledged about ourselves right now? A poor or a limited, or at very least, let's assume that every one of these was a good influence. That's a stretch, but let's just assume for a moment that they were. We'd still have owned them simply because they were given to us, not because we chose them. So in the end, can a man be successful unless he has been an active participant in what defines success for him? Ah, everybody hear that? And so a man gets to the point where he has achieved everything that would define him as being successful according to these people, and yet he's miserable on the inside. We've talked about this already multiple times. How long does it take to acquire success? The success that you might have been dictated to, according to these terms. Okay, let's just get real. Let's get practical. What are some of the expressions of success in our country?
Money.
Okay. A reasonable amount of money. Enough for four generations. Okay, so that's one thing. And incidentally, nothing wrong with any of these. And I don't want us to go down the stereotypical, oh, we're in church, so we have to have these answers. Okay? I want us to all be brutally honest with who we are and where we are. Because it's like we've already concluded, if most of us spend very little thoughtful, reflective time contemplating what it means to be a success, then we're allowing others to mold and shape who we are. Money. What else? Oh, whoa, easy. One at a time. He was first.
Things.
Yeah. The house, the car.
Oh, stop. Ron added something new. He said, and he said house, or he said things, actually, and we were going to itemize some things. And then he said, but I seem to care a little bit less about them the older I get. If you've read through the book of Ecclesiastes, do you not see that same sort of conclusion that Solomon draws? So I have an interesting question. Ron, don't hate me for this, okay? Is this just a dilemma that old people face? As opposed to young people? Okay. What else? That's a good one. Did somebody else say power? Okay. Feel no guilt. You're not the first, you're not the second, you're probably not even the tenth.
I think he's the skinniest, though.
What else?
Desire to have other people appreciate you.
Yeah. Acceptance. I'm going to put a slash there, respect.
Recognition.
Can we lump that in with status? Status and recognition?
Yeah.
Keep focused here, all right?
Influence, growth, and other people.
Influence.
Growth or helping other people.
Okay, influence over other, positive influence on other people? What else? Well, this one isn't necessarily, although in a way it is if you're doing it solely for the purpose of making yourself feel good. Okay, so those are what we're all saying are things that would be molded into us, shaped into us. So, if that's true, and you gave me the words, all right, remember that. I didn't give you the words. If that is true, and these are your words, how much of this is already in you? Just stop and think about that. Now here's a question. Are you a hoarder? And I don't mean do you keep stuff in your basement, in your garage? But do you ever expel ideas from your thinking? Or do you simply, are you a collector that just gathers more and you try to integrate them into your current understandings? When is the last time you had a personal moment of discovery where you said, that no longer has room in my life and I discard that way of thinking? When's the last time that occurred? Or do you just kind of like, put another layer, like painting a building, and we'll put another layer on top of it, of the existing layers of paint. And so we'll put a fresh idea over the existing idea that was there before. And that might work with paint, but it really doesn't work with thinking. I think there's times in a man's life when he has to have what we'll call mental purging. There's some junk in us that's got to go.
I think you do that when you realize that the whole idea of all that you always have to have more. No matter how much it is, you always have to have more.
And so we'll go to the top of the second page. Well done, Art.
I think of mental purging. I think for me, some of the hardest concepts where I get to hear of seeing someone you really respected.
Oh, yeah.
Father, maybe. He's not perfect. He might have some ideas that he took on that they're hard to get rid of because you're like going against him. In your mind, you're like, well, that means my dad's wrong, or whatever. So that's kind of a mental battle.
You know, Tom, it's a funny thing you brought that up. We're just going to hold Tom's idea, we're going to hold Art's idea, and we're going to move to the top of the second page. Now, and maybe you've already heard this, and it's this idea of introduced to us in sort of what we'll say is common folk wisdom by Ben Franklin. He said, every man has a certain set of desires and expectations in life. And every man has a certain level of income. And many people find themselves in a circumstance where the level of income does not match their level of desire. Has anyone in the room ever experienced that? I don't make enough to get all the stuff that I would really like. And he says, at that moment when a man finally draws that conclusion that these two are not reconcilable, I want this, but I can only buy this, he has one of two choices. This is Franklin's statement. He can either elevate his income till his income comes up to the point that it matches his desires, or he can lower his expectations until it drops down to the level of his income. And I know for some of us, we can remember a time when if you were to drop your expectations to the level of your income, your expectations would have some plummeting to do. Now, at least superficially, knowing what we all know about human nature, do you see any glaring error in Franklin's statement? And it's, interestingly enough, not a bad statement. It's a good guy. It's not totally inaccurate. But when he says, that a man can raise his level of income to meet his expectations, what do you see that might be a trap there? Yeah, have you ever known a man who didn't want more as soon as he had everything he had? Show of hands, how many of you have everything that you will ever want for the rest of your life, and you have it right now? Tomorrow's meal? Ah, you won't be able to get that till tomorrow. It's in the freezer. Haven't we all been caught in that, though? So what does that do? That puts us on this treadmill where we're just constantly chasing the expectations that we set for ourselves. And it would be bad enough if we set the expectations, but remember our definition of success that we've already put down there? And we discovered that a lot of what we describe as success isn't even things that we pick. Wouldn't it be tragic for a man to spend the rest of his life chasing something that he didn't even know he was supposed to want but was given to him by somebody else? Have you ever done that? And here's the next principle of finance. It's the idea of diminishing return. The simplest way to describe it is this. Two men go out. One has $100,000 to spend. One has $500,000 to spend. One buys a nice BMW. The other buys a nice Maserati. Is the man who owns the Maserati five times as happy as the man who owns the BMW? Of course not. There's a principle of diminishing return. Well, the more of something we have, let's say if the difference between having none of something and having this much of it was ecstatic joy and happiness. Does doubling that double the amount of joy and happiness? And it doesn't. But people continue to chase the more because what else is there? And then there's the other perplexing thing about this, which is there seems to be more joy in the wanting and the pursuit toward getting than there is in the having. Who of us in this room hasn't gotten the exact precise thing that they work for? And it was a good thing. They wanted it. How long does the happiness of owning that thing last? Honestly. And yet we fall prey to it, don't we? Every one of us. Now, we're going to pick up on what Tom said. And I want to introduce another new point here. This is so stupid sounding that everybody says, well, this is obvious. But yet we don't live like it's obvious. We only want what we don't have. And we live our lives toward what we want. How many of you are chasing what you already have? We only chase what we don't have. I want us to look at the life of Solomon. And I hope Scott is going to be able to use this to tie back into his lesson next week. Solomon is a man who becomes king almost not even as the result of his own efforts. Solomon's dad is David. David, by being obedient, but also by working hard, by being diligent, by being courageous, and working long, finds himself in the position of leader of Israel. It was a long and difficult road for David. It was filled with uncertainty. It was filled with fear. It was filled with a lot of fighting. It was filled with surrounding yourself with brave and courageous men. And together, they found themselves in a position of authority one day. Solomon is the child of a middle-aged man who is no longer in the midst of struggle. And just think about this, because this is profound. Solomon never grew up in the court of a dad who was struggling, working his way up, fighting to succeed. Solomon was the product of a man who had arrived, was comfortable, and could bless his child with everything that the boy wanted. Yes. Now, that doesn't mean that David was stupid. But what we do know is this. While David was an immensely capable and talented leader in public, we all know that David was less than a stellar dad. For some reason, he didn't seem to get the relationship component of his life down well. And what he bequeaths to Solomon, unfortunately, is a legacy of chasing what David never gave him. And this is the side of the story that I think many people miss. Solomon becomes the product of the chasing to get what he never got. Solomon had no opportunity to prove to his father that he was capable and earn his way into success. There's no record of the fact that there was any co-regency for a period of years. As a matter of fact, when it is time for Solomon to become king, there's a guy in front of him, his older brother from a different wife, who wants to steal the throne. Anybody remember the story? An older brother by the name of Adonijah, and he sets himself up to be the leader and conspires with some of the people in David's own government to set himself up. Now think about this. This is a mature man. Do you know how he ends up becoming king? Because his mom goes in to see his dad, David, and says, "Do you know what's happening out there? I thought you promised me that our son would be king." Underneath all the glory, all the wisdom, all the pomp, all of everything else is a man who was handed what he got. And he never got, I believe, to see his father say, "That's my boy, and he's done that, and I'm proud of you, son." And look at this sad legacy. Now, Tom said that sometimes our parents give us things. Things that we maybe not want. This is 1 Kings chapter 2. If you want to go back and check it out on your own, just in case you doubt the way I'm telling this story. When David's time to die drew near, he commanded Solomon his son, saying, and these words are going to go down like honey, and they sound so right. "I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man." Doesn't sound bad, does it? As a matter of fact, in my annotations here in the margins, it suggests that this is very similar to the charge that was given to Joshua. I wish I had the man who wrote these annotations right in front of me, because I'd have to strongly disagree with him. Does anybody know about the history of Joshua? He worked side by side with Moses for 40 years until the day when Moses and God said those words to him. "Be strong and show yourself a man." What do you think David's really saying? "Maybe I don't really have total confidence in you. I hope you can prove yourself." And we're going to read on here. "Walking and keeping, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses." And all that sounds fine. "That you may prosper in all you do, wherever you turn, that the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning..." Is anybody following along with us? Then let me read this carefully. "The Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me." This is David talking. "That he spoke concerning me, that if your sons pay close attention to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel." First Kings, second chapter. He doesn't come right out and say this, but what is David's dying concern?
His own legacy.
At least in part, isn't it? Now, we're not saying that a man shouldn't have a sense of destiny and legacy. I'm not saying that that is completely wrong. But at the moment, this is the deathbed moment. These are the lasting, lingering words that Solomon is going to carry with him for the rest of his life. Son, I want you to remember the family legacy. And then we get into a few personal side notes, right? It's like, if there was an audience for the first part, you could imagine David like sending all the other people out of the room at this moment. Who had their hand up?
Instead of encouraging, it's sort of like, don't let me down.
And we understand David's heart in certain ways. And we're not saying that this is all wrong. But just think for yourself. What are the words that you want to linger in the lives of those who will come after you and carry into the next generation? And now come the small and subtle directions. Moreover, you also know that Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me how he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner, the son of Ner. And I'm just going to jump past all that. Act therefore according to your wisdom. But do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. What's he saying? There's a little bit of messy business that I didn't attend to that wouldn't have looked good for me, or I didn't have the opportunity. But Solomon, you'll know how to fix up that little mess. How'd you like to have to carry that with you? There's more. And there is also with you Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who cursed me with a grievous curse on the day when I went to Mahanaim. Now therefore, do not hold him guiltless. And again, for you are a wise man, you will know what you ought to do with him. And you shall bring his gray head down with blood to Sheol. The parting words that are going to be the guide light for your reign. Huh?
Success.
Solomon early on seems to show great promise. And we don't discount the sincerity of his prayer for wisdom. As a matter of fact, God recognizes that sincerity. We also have to recognize that God is not necessarily favoring only Solomon with that prayer, but obviously is favoring his own people. Here's what God is saying. You've made a good request, Solomon, in asking for wisdom, and I'm going to honor that request. But also, Solomon, I need you to be wise for the sake of my people, because I love my people. So of course I'm going to bless you with wisdom. But Solomon's own life reveals something different. So if you move down to the middle of the paper, the story of Ecclesiastes is essentially the story of a man who fills his life with the pursuit of more. But his mores are not that much different than most of the mores that all of us want. Number one is more knowing. Remember, he sets himself up to learn about everything that he possibly can, to acquire wisdom, to acquire knowledge about animals and plants and this and that. He sets himself up to acquire more. Why do people want to acquire knowledge? For their own benefit. Is it exclusively for your own benefit?
Power?
Huh?
Understanding?
How about to impress other people? You're a bum.
I mean me.
Oh, okay. Is there anything wrong with acquiring more knowledge? Of course there isn't. Here's the internal question that each of us has to ask. Is my pursuit of something, and we're going to introduce another word that ties directly into success, is my pursuit of whatever I am pursuing in line with the unique purpose that God has given me? And because we're limited on time, I'm going to start to fuse some ideas together here. Ultimately, success has to be measured according to purpose. Solomon saw ownership and attainment as the route to happiness. And in case you think you're too sophisticated to fall for that, let's remember that this is Solomon. This is not a man who should be easily deluded by the superficial. Do you hear me? I mean, do you really get it? Solomon, who many people believe is the wisest man who ever lived apart from Jesus, fell into a trap that a blind man should have sensed coming. Now, if Solomon could fall into that trap and arrive at the end of his life bitter, unhappy, and angry, and he's Solomon, do you think that any of us in this room could fall prey to that? And as a matter of fact, listen to me. My name is Glenn and I love y'all, okay? There's probably people in this room that are still walking in that trap, or maybe you're groping around at the bottom of the trap and trying to find your way out. It is impossible to find success and contentment apart from living on purpose. God calls us, and this is the big idea, all put together in a nutshell, and then we're going to come back and we're going to revisit it in pieces. God calls us to be stewards, not owners. When we place our focus on ownership rather than stewardship, we will feel great in the minute. It's kind of like a momentary high that is followed by a long come down after the high. Every time and in any way in your life, when you set yourself up to own rather than to steward, and to please yourself in the moment rather than to look at the long-term picture, there will be a long-term consequence and you won't like it. And we're not so different from the addict who will live for the next high and suffer further down the road for that high. Let's come back to the Moors. To accomplish more. Just to do more. To do more new great things. To work harder. And where does that come from? Why do we constantly press to do more? And if it's not out of a sense of stewardship. And let me ask it to you a different way so that you can really see it clearly. Do you think that God, who has given you a mission in life, would work you to death in the process of giving you that mission? Does that make sense? Would a loving God work you to death in the pursuit of what He called you to do? How many of us go around feeling fatigued constantly? And I'm not saying that there's not moments when we're tired. Of course there are. I'm just saying, is that your perpetual condition? And at that point, are you living in God's call in your life, or are you living in your own or somebody else's definition of success that's been given to you? And I'm not saying that this is your excuse. You know what we learned today, honey? We learned that I need to be lazier. I'm just too driven. So, you know what? Today the house is on you. I don't think I'm going to participate. That's not what you heard here this morning. Now here's the next one, the number three that we're all familiar with Solomon, to experience more. Have more pleasure. Have more new cool experiences. Now that can just be a diversion, but have you ever been haunted by the truth that you know but you don't want to deal with in your own life, and so you find a way to shut down your mind when it's pointing you to something that you know you need to deal with? But instead of dealing honestly with it, you go off and find a distraction, because if you can quiet the demons in your own mind, maybe they'll go away for a little while, so you just go off and please yourself. I'm probably not talking about any of you, but can you imagine that your neighbor might do that? And finally, the acquiring more. To own enough, to prove your self-worth. And here is the principle that comes at the end of all of the Moors. And I can just tell you how the end of the story works. Look, if you're 20 years, if you got a 20-year map for getting everything you want in life, you cannot get enough of what you don't need to replace what you do. You can't get enough money to replace love. You can't get enough fill in the blank. You can't get enough success to replace significance. You cannot get enough of the thing that is missing in your life, or enough of something else to replace the thing that is missing in your life. So don't even bother the chase. You'll just tire yourself in the pursuit. Do you know what's driving you? That's an inner question. Do you know what is driving you and pushing you forward? Here's the interesting thing that Solomon battles with. He doesn't quite understand how to have connection with God. And so he comes to the point, and actually I think we're going to read a couple of verses here now. We'll go back over to Ecclesiastes. Some of these verses are going to be very familiar to you. And I'd like you to visit them again, visit them fresh, and I want you to feel the torment in this man as he's writing this. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. And also, he has put eternity into a man's heart. Yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. This is the first clue as to something that's dogging at Solomon. I already know that everything that I am doing, I'm going to have to leave behind. I already know that most of what I am doing is not going to last. I just have this burning sense that there is something more. There's something inside of me that says there's something that I'm missing. And I don't know what it is, and I can't find it. God has put a sense of the eternal in my heart, and I don't know what to do with it. And it doesn't reconcile with everything I see around me. Let's read on. We'll go over to the 9th chapter. And I'm not taking us on this tour just so that we can cram a little bit of Bible in here. I want you to feel the pain in the guy's life and see what he's living with. And his pain sometimes is not so much different than ours. We're going to start at the first verse. But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hands of God. Whether it is to love or to hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It is the same for all. Since the same events happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and to the evil, to the clean and to the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner. Before I read on, what's he saying? And even in my humanness, it looks as if, in the end, we all come to the same end. Good, bad, rich, poor, no matter what the comparison, no matter what the extremes, he says, there seems to be an emptiness in me because it seems that no matter what, I can live the best life possible, and in the end, who cares? I'm going to die. And it's all gone. Turn to one more place yet. And here's where it gets really real. Chapter 7, start at the first verse. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. This guy's really on a morbidity kick, but listen to what he says. This is profound. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind. And the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. But the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. Does anybody understand what he's saying? He's not only saying that, He's saying the end that comes to all people is death. He says happiness. The happiness even that I'm pursuing. Remember how he describes himself when I read at the beginning? An old man who's abandoned wisdom. He said there was hope for the young guy who was pursuing wisdom, but here I find myself at the end of life and I haven't lived according to the wisdom that I know. He said it would be well for all of us to take stock to spend time in the house of mourning. Because the house of mourning ultimately is my end place. And if I don't come to terms with the fact that my life here and now is someday going to end, I'm forced to live a life of distraction. And if I can't, and this is Solomon's haunting challenge. What do I do with the fact that I know I'm going to die? And as long as I know I'm going to die, I can never actually relax and be happy. Because it haunts me all the time. Okay, I have happiness now, but what about tomorrow? Tomorrow could be my end. And so what you see in there is a life of a man who is intent on drowning out the reality that he knows by the next fix he can get in the moment. And the only difference between Solomon and a lot of people is Solomon at least understood that but didn't know what to do with it. Most of us don't even understand that. We've been given some guiding principles for what we think is going to be success and we pour all of our energy into that and we never even self-reflect. Solomon spent enough time to self-reflect so that he could actually understand this, but he didn't know what to do with the understanding he got. So what do we do with this? Where do we go with this? So here's the first thing that we all need to take away from this. You and I can never ultimately be either successful or happy if we can't rest in the love and the acceptance of something. In almost every one of those categories up there, some way or another, the words love and acceptance came up. Use different words for it. Love and acceptance are at the heart of what we crave. How many sources of love and acceptance do you actually know in this world? Unconditional love and full acceptance. How many sources do you really know, truthfully? I know we all like to think that we love people unconditionally, but can we be really, really brutally honest? Do we? I mean, we try in our own imperfect human way, but do we? Until who I am on the inside can find a resting place in the only being that can love me and accept me, then we go through life having to bury that. Or we make the other choice, which is just not to think about it. And once we do that, until we understand that if we live as stewards working toward the purpose that God has given us, that God carries that purpose. Remember Solomon's complaint? Everything that I own, I'm going to have to pass on to somebody else, and who knows what they're going to do with it. The toil of my lifetime, and I'm going to hand it to my kids, and who knows how they're going to spend it. But if I've spent my life invested in relaxing in the love and acceptance that God has, not working to earn it, but working out of a devotion and a love for God, and if I am confident that that God who has given me this purpose will carry it through and it will have lasting value. In other words, what I do here does matter for more than now. And I will get to see the results someday, even if I don't get to see them now. And if you don't come to peace with that, and if I don't come to peace with that, we live tortured or deadened lives here. We live tortured because we know the truth, but we don't know what to do with it. Or we live deadened lives because we need to evade the truth because it hurts too much when we look it in the face. And that's it in a nutshell. And that's the choice that every one of us has to make. And I am now officially done. On time, too. How's that, Scott?